Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to pull out the key ideas from interesting sources for you.
Yeah, making complex stuff a bit easier to grasp.
And today, we're tackling a real giant of physics, Coulomb's Law. We're using some excerpts from a physics textbook as our guide.
A fundamental law, really.
Right. And our mission, really, is just to unpack it, make it clear, maybe even interesting, no matter your background. Whether you're revisiting this or it's brand new.
We want to get into what it is, how Coulomb even figured it out, and, you know, why it's just so important.
Exactly. It's all about the electric force, which, when you think about it, holds pretty much everything together.
It really does. It shapes matter itself.
Okay, so let's dive in. Coulomb's Law. At its heart, it describes the force between two point charges.
Right. And point charges, well, that's a key idea here.
What does that mean exactly?
It basically means, you know, charged things whose actual physical size is, well, it's negligible, tiny compared to how far apart they are.
Like dust motes across a room. Their size doesn't really matter for the force calculation at that distance.
Precisely. You can treat them like all their charges packed into a single point. It just simplifies the math enormously.
Makes sense. And that simplification leads us straight to the equation, the mathematical heart of Coulomb's Law, at least in a vacuum. It's F equals K times Q1 times Q2, all divided by R squared.
Okay, let's pick that apart a bit. F, that's the force, like the strength of the push or pull.
The magnitude.
Right, magnitude. Q1 and Q2, those are the amounts of charge on our two points. How much charge each one has.
Okay.
R's is the distance between them. And notice it's R squared in the bottom there. That's really important.
Yeah, the square is key. And K.
K is just a constant. Think of it like a scaling factor that makes the units work out correctly. A proportionality constant.
So looking at that formula, you can see straight away how force depends on charge and distance.
Yeah.
It's proportional to the charges, right?
Exactly. If you double the charge on one, Q1, say, you double the force F. Simple as that. More charge, more force.
But the distance part, that's where the inverse square comes in.
That's the really interesting bit, yeah. Force is inversely proportional to the square of the distance.
So if you double the distance.
The force doesn't just halve, it drops to 1/4 of what it was. Triple the distance. It's 1/9 the force. It falls off really quickly as things get further apart.
Wow. And this force, it acts along the line connecting the two charges.
Always. Straight line between them. Either pushing them apart if the charges are the same or pulling them together if they're opposite. Along that invisible line.
Okay, so that's the law itself. But how did Coulomb figure this out back in the, what, late 1700s? No fancy electronics then?
No, definitely not. It's a story of real experimental cleverness. He used something called a torsion balance.
A torsion balance?
Yeah. Picture a delicate fiber that twists. The amount it twists tells you how much force is being applied. It's incredibly sensitive. He'd put charges on little metallic spheres and measure the tiny forces between them by how much this fiber twisted.
Okay, I can picture that. But how did he know how much charge, like the quantity of charge he was putting on the spheres?
Huh.
That seems like a problem if you don't have a defined unit yet.
That was the problem. The Coulomb unit didn't exist. But he had this incredibly elegant workaround.
Go on.
He figured that if you take a charged metal sphere and touch it to an identical uncharged sphere, the charge has to spread out evenly, right? By symmetry.
Ah, so if the first sphere had charge Q.
Then, after touching, they'd each have Q divided by 2, half the original charge.
Okay.
And he could do it again. Touch one of those spheres to another identical uncharged one, and you get Q over 4, then Q over 8, and so on.
That is clever.
Yeah.
He could create known fractions of his starting charge without knowing the absolute amount.
Exactly. So he could systematically change the charges by factors of 2, and he could carefully measure the distances, and then he measured the resulting force with his torsion balance. He just meticulously mapped it all out.
And saw the pattern emerge, the direct relation to the product of charges, and that inverse square relation to distance.
That's how he did it. Found the law from those careful, systematic measurements. And what's amazing is he did this with, you know, visible spheres, but the law holds true right down to the subatomic level, around 10 to the minus 10 meters. It scales incredibly well.
And all before the unit of charge was formally defined. That's quite something. So how did we actually get the Coulomb and that constant K?
Well, that constant K was, for a while, basically up for grabs. You could choose a value for K, and that choice would then implicitly define how big your unit of charge was.
So the choice of K sets the size of the charge unit.
Precisely. Eventually, in the standard system, the SI units we use today, they decided to fix the value of K. It's approximately 9 times 10 to the power of 9. The units are Newton meters squared per Coulomb squared, NMCC.
Okay, so fixing A defines the Coulomb, the C.
Yes. And just to give you a feel for how big a Coulomb is, imagine you had two charges, each exactly 1 Coulomb, and you placed them 1 meter apart in a vacuum.
Okay.
The repulsive force between them would be that value of K, 9 times 10 to the 9 Newtons.
9 billion Newtons. That sounds huge.
It's enormous, like roughly the weight of a million tons. So 1 Coulomb is actually a massive amount of charge in practical terms.
Which explains why in electrostatics labs or real circuits, you usually hear about microcoulombs or nanocoulombs, much smaller amounts.
Exactly. Micro is a millionth, nano is a billionth. Much more manageable numbers for typical situations. Now, there's another way you often see Coulomb's law written.
Oh.
Yeah, instead of K, sometimes people use a different constant called the permittivity of free space. It's written as epsilon naught.
Epsilon naught, okay.
The law then looks like F equals 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught times Q1 Q2 over R squared.
It looks more complicated, but you're saying it's the same law.
Fundamentally, yes. The constant K is just equal to 1 divided by 4 pi ace. Epsilon naught itself has a value about 8.854 times 10 to the minus 12, C and Neumer. It just turns out that using epsilon naught is often more convenient for more advanced stuff in electricity and magnetism later on.
Got it. Different way of writing the same relationship, useful down the line. Okay, so we've got the magnitude, the strength of the force. But force has direction, right? It's a vector.
Absolutely. Critical point. Knowing how strong the force isn't enough. You need to know which way it's pushing or pulling. That's where the vector form of Coulomb's law comes in.
Okay, how does that work?
So imagine our charges, Q1 and Q2, are at specific locations in space. We can describe those locations with position vectors, say R1 and R2, pointing from some origin.
Like arrows from a starting point to each charge.
Exactly. Then we can define a vector that points from Q1 to Q2. Let's call it R21. Mathematically, it's just R2 minus R1.
Okay, the displacement from 1 to 2.
Right, and the vector pointing the other way from Q2 to Q1 we'd call R12, which is R1 minus R2. It's just the negative of R21. They point in opposite directions, but their length, their magnitude is the same. It's just the distance R we used before.
Makes sense.
Now, to get just the direction, we use unit vectors. Remember those? Vectors with a length of exactly 1.
Yeah, they just point the way.
So we define a unit vector. Let's call it R hat 21, by taking the vector R21 and dividing it by its own length, R, this R21 points exactly from Q1 towards Q2.
Got it.
Now, the force on charge Q2 due to charge Q1, which we can call F21, is given by that second form of the law we saw. 1/4 times Q1, Q2, R. That's the magnitude part multiplied by this unit vector, R21.
So the first chunk is the strength, same as before, and multiplying by R hat 21 tacks on the direction pointing along the line from Q1 to Q2.
Precisely. And the beauty of this is how it handles attraction and repulsion automatically.
How so?
Well, think about the signs of the charges, Q1 and Q2. If they're both positive or both negative-like charges, then their product, Q1 times Q2, is positive.
Right.
So F21 has the same sign as R21. It points in the same direction as R21, meaning it points away from Q1. That's repulsion.
Okay. And if they're opposite charges, one positive, one negative,
then the product Q1 times Q2 is negative. So F21 points in the opposite direction to R21, which means it points back towards Q1. That's attraction.
Wow. Okay. So one equation covers both cases just based on the signs of the charges. That's pretty elegant.
It really is. And it gets better. If you work out the force on Q1 due to Q2, which is F12, you use the unit vector pointing from Q2 to Q1, which is R12. But R12 is just the negative of R21.
So F12 must be the negative of F21.
Exactly. F12 x negative 4, 1. The force on 1 due to 2 is equal in magnitude and precisely opposite in direction to the force on 2 due to 1.
That sounds familiar. Newton's third law. Action, reaction.
That's it. Exactly. Coulomb's law fits perfectly with Newton's third law. It's fundamental.
Okay, that vector stuff really clarifies the directionality. Now, the textbook excerpts you mentioned had some really striking examples comparing this electric force to gravity. Let's talk about example 1.3.
Yeah, this is where you really see the scale difference. Both Coulomb's law and Newton's gravity have that inverse square dependence on distance, right?
Right. Both drop off as 1 over r squared.
But their intrinsic strengths are just worlds apart. The example calculates the ratio, the electric force, divided by the gravitational force between an electron and a proton.
And the number is just astronomical. Or is it 2.4 times 10 to the power of 39?
Something like that, yeah. A 24 followed by 38 zeros. It's almost impossible to even imagine how much stronger the electrical interaction is compared to gravity between these fundamental particles.
It totally explains why chemistry and material science are all about electromagnetism, not gravity. Gravity just doesn't play a role at that scale.
It's completely negligible, and the ratio for two protons is similarly huge, like 1.3 times 10 to the 76. Again, electric force utterly dominates. And remember, gravity only attracts.
Whereas electric force can attract or repel. Big difference.
Huge difference. The example even put some numbers on it for two protons inside a nucleus, maybe 10, 15 meters apart.
Super close.
The electric repulsion is about 230 newtons, which is a pretty hefty force, actually, while the gravitational attraction between them is, well, it's down around 1.9 times 10 to the minus 34 newtons. It's just nothing in comparison.
Wow. 230N versus almost zero.
Okay. It hammers home why we need the strong nuclear force to hold nuclei together against that massive electrical repulsion, but that's another story. The example also looks at accelerations.
Right. Part B. An electron and a proton separated by about an angstrom, like in an atom.
Yeah, 10 to the minus 10 meters. It calculates the acceleration each one experiences due to their mutual electric attraction.
And the numbers were crazy high, weren't they?
Absolutely phenomenal. The electron, being much lighter, gets accelerated at something like 2.5 times 10 to the power of 22 meters per second squared.
10 to the 22.
And the proton, much heavier, still gets a massive kick around 1.4 times 10 to the power of 19 meters of stress. These things are being yanked around with incredible force at the atomic scale.
So again, gravity is just completely swamped. Not even relevant in these calculations.
Utterly irrelevant. It's all Coulomb force down there.
Okay, there was another interesting example. Example 1.4. It was about charge redistribution.
Yes. This one highlights how Coulomb's law interacts with other basic principles like charge conservation, the fact that charge isn't created or destroyed, just moved.
And charge additivity, you just add charges up.
Right. So the setup is you have two charged metal spheres, A and B, pushing each other apart. Repulsion.
Okay, like charges.
Then you take an identical uncharged sphere C and touch it to sphere A.
Like before. The charge shares equally. If A had Q, now A and C each have Q2.
Exactly. And you do the same with another uncharged sphere D and sphere B. If B had Q prime, now B and D each have Q prime over 2.
Got it. Each sphere's charge is halved. Then what?
Then the question is, what happens to the force between A and B if you now move them so the distance between them is also halved?
Okay, so the charge on each is halved and the distance is halved. What happens?
You might think the force changes dramatically, but the result is actually the force stays exactly the same.
No way. How?
Well, think about the formula. F is proportional to Q1, Q2, R red. The product of the charges went from QQ down to Q2, Q2, which is QQ4. So the charge part made the force four times weaker.
Okay, factor of 14 from the charges.
But the distance R was halved, and force depends on 1 over R squared. So if R becomes R2, then R becomes R2, which is R4, and 1 over R4 is 4R. The distance part makes the force four times stronger.
So a factor of 14 for the charges and a factor of 4 from the distance. They cancel out perfectly.
Exactly. The force remains unaltered in that specific scenario. It's a neat demonstration of how the different parts of the law interact and how charge conservation plays out.
That's really cool. Shows you have to consider all the factors.
Definitely. Now, one important caveat to all this. We've mostly been talking about Coulomb's law in a vacuum.
Right. You mentioned that. No air, no materials in between.
Yes. When you put stuff matter between the charges or around them, things get more complicated. The electric fields interact with the charges inside the material itself. You get effects like polarization, shielding.
Which changes the effective force between the original charges.
It can, yes. So understanding electrostatics and matter is a whole other layer on top of the basic vacuum law. Something for another time, perhaps.
A future deep dive, maybe. Yeah. Okay, so let's try and wrap this up. Key takeaways from digging into Coulomb's law today.
Well, we saw it's the fundamental rule for force between point charges depends directly on the product of charges.
And inversely on the square of the distance. That inverse square is huge.
Absolutely. We saw how Coulomb cleverly measured it using a torsion balance even before the unit of charge was defined.
And how the constant K, or alternatively 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, sets the scale and defines the Coulomb unit.
Which is a very large unit in practice. We also covered the vector form, which elegantly handles direction, attraction, and repulsion, and links up with Newton's third law.
And those examples really drove home the sheer strength of the electric force compared to gravity at small scales. It's just dominant.
Completely dominant. And we saw how charge conservation leads to interesting results, like in that charge redistribution example where the force surprisingly stayed the same.
Understanding this law really feels like getting a key piece of the puzzle for understanding, well, almost everything physical and chemical.
It truly is foundational for physics, for engineering, for chemistry, biology. It underpins so much.
So here's a final thought for you listening in. We've talked about this force between simple charges, but think about how this same fundamental law governs the structure of atoms, how electrons orbit nuclei, how atoms bond to form molecules, the very building blocks of you and everything around you.
Mm-hmm. All dictated by this relatively simple inverse square law.
So the question is, what other seemingly simple rules might be hiding beneath the surface, orchestrating the complex world we see?
Something to ponder.
Indeed. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Coulomb's Law.
Hope it was useful.
Until next time, keep exploring the forces that shape our universe.